he actually worked for the SBI for a while.
The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. It is September 11th, 2013, and we have our two-day agenda before us this afternoon, tomorrow morning. We're going to hold off on the minutes to see if we do have a quorum at some point. So let's start with unless anyone has anything they want to say. Let's start with the First Class City Teacher Retirement Plan Consolidation Study, our first consideration. And we'll start out with a staff report.
Members, I will be brief with this. You have an item in your packets dated September 4th. It has to do with the topic of the First Class City Teacher Retirement Plan consolidation issue. The memo, as we do with most or with the various first considerations of interim topics, we try and get before you as much of the information that might be useful or informative that we can compile. And so you have a large amount of information of a general nature of having to do with the mandate in the 2013 session law, background information on the benefit plan, the membership, the governance, and the state funding of the various teacher pension funds over time, some information about past legislative and commission efforts to address this topic, and then some information about the Minneapolis Teachers Plan, which consolidated in 2006. We're going to be hearing shortly from TRA and from the Duluth Teachers Plan about the bones of the consolidation study that they're starting to conduct. That's required under laws 2013, Chapter 11, 111, Article 13, Section 22. That's summarized for you in the middle of page 1. It requires them over the course of this interim for reporting back for the next session what it would take to the feasibility and the requirements necessary to achieve a consolidation of the two first-class city teacher plans into the statewide teacher pension plan. The information about TRA, about Duluth Teachers, and about St. Paul Teachers is attached to your memo, and I would refer you to that if you want to get a sense of the funding of these plans. If you turn to page 17 of the staff memo, it would be the start of attachment D as in David. That puts side by side basic information, membership, and actuarial and funding information side by side for the three pension funds. And this on the top of the table, it's for 2012, the most recent actuarial work that's been received by the Pension Commission. The 2013 information will be coming around December, January. And then for the next several pages, I've given you some prior information every year back to 2008, and then in five-year increments back as far as the Commission has been getting regular actuarial reporting from the three plans, so you can get some sense of how things have developed or changed over time. On pages 2, 3, and 4 of the memo is information about past times that the Pension Commission has looked at this topic. The idea of having these plans consolidate is not brand spanking new, and this will give you some sense about the efforts of the commission in years past. Madam Chair, with that, I think maybe having Ms. Hacking and Mr. Stoffel give their presentation may be appropriate at this point.
Okay, thank you. It's very interesting to look at the history. 1983 was not a good year. We look back. I was 78. Okay. Any questions for the staff or members of the commission? Then let's invite Ms. Hacking and Mr. Stoffel. Welcome. Proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Laurie Hacking, Executive Director of Teachers Retirement Association.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Jay Stoffel, Director of Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. And I will start off the presentation today. I believe everyone has a 4 or 5 page handout titled Consolidation Study Update.
It's two pages.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I believe it's four slides.
Yeah.
Start off on page one, and this is really meant just to give you an update, commission members, an update as to how we've been proceeding with the mandate to study consolidation of the three teacher funds, the St. Paul and Duluth teacher plan, into the TRA.
Mr. Stoffel, are you going to use the overhead projector?
I wasn't planning on it, Madam Chair.
You weren't planning on it?
Okay.
It's set up. I think Jay and I didn't talk about this.
Okay. I guess we will.
Is it somewhere on? You don't know. Someone else set this up, so I apologize. I think Senate Media wanted us to use this, but
what does it look like?
Do you have one of those?
Is this what they're referring to?
I don't see just this. One page. Just this.
I apologize. We weren't planning, obviously, to do this, but we were just
flash drive back from Senate Media.
We did.
You did, because that's what you use to plug into this. So maybe it'd be best to not use it. Okay, you can just close it.
Sorry about that.
I don't have it.
Okay, with you, Madam Chair, we'll dispense with the overheads.
Okay, maybe we could get the screen to go dark then. There we go. Oh, no, it's bad.
I should have just left it off.
Oh, wow.
There we go. I think if it sits,
it'll go off eventually.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe we could ask Lisa. Lisa, could you turn off the projector?
Yes.
She can squeeze through there. Okay. Let's continue then.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, as you're aware, the 2013 legislation, the Omnibus Pension Bill, required the boards and the directors of the three teacher funds to study the merger, the consolidation of the first-class city teacher funds into the TRA. And there are a few key principles that we've been working from, some of them are outlined on page 2, but we will be doing detailed actuarial analysis to define the financial requirements to consolidate the Duluth plan into the TRA and also the St. Paul plan into the TRA in a manner that's consistent with past practice. There's a history of mergers in the state of Minnesota, merging pension funds into either the TRA or the PERA. So there is plenty of past practice to look back on. Some of the key principles are outlined in the three bullet points on page 2. We want to assure, and the law requires us to assure, that the assets of the TRA are protected. And what we're getting at there, and what's important to know, is that we're merging three different plans with three different funding ratios. At last measure, June 30, 2012, the TRA was 73% funded, the Duluth plan was 63% funded, and the St. Paul plan was 62% funded. So merging those three plans into one raises a lot of interesting questions about how to do this. And what's important is that, and the law requires that we do this study and come up with methods that assure that the assets of the TRA are protected. And it's from the TRA perspective because they have the highest funding ratio. If we're coming into a plan from Duluth's perspective with a lower funding ratio into a higher funded plan, the question is, who's going to make up that difference, and how does that work? So we're developing actuarial information to help the Pension Commission and the legislature look at that issue. The other principle is that the merged funds are fully funded. I think it's safe to say that the past history, the past practice in the state of Minnesota, that with other mergers, the Minneapolis Teacher Plan, the MRF Plan, and others, there have been plans to make sure that those merged funds achieve full funding at some point. So that's a principle we're dealing with.
Do you mean that that's a, it's a long-term plan to do that, or do you mean that the merged funds come in at a at 100% funding?
Madam Chair, actually, those are two methods that you could use, and I think we'll be laying both of those out.
Okay.
On the date of consolidation, you can look at this to say that the Duluth plan should be brought to the level of the TRA plan on that day in a lump sum, and that gets us kind of on an even basis at that point. The other approach would be, how do we get to be fully funded so that we can tell the TRA members especially that their plan is not subsidizing the Duluth plan as far as this merger. So there are different ways of approaching that. The third principle is that, well, and it's kind of the same thing, that the TRA is not subsidizing the merged funds. I think when you're in the higher funded plan, there was a time, I remember maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago when this discussion would come up regularly, and the Duluth plan was fully funded and the TRA was not fully funded. So we were looking at it from the TRA's perspective. But the perspective of the higher funded plan is always that we have a higher funding ratio and those assets are for the benefit of those members and for that plan and shouldn't be used for other purposes. So those are some of the guiding principles that we want to use as we develop this report and keep those things in mind as primary considerations as we're developing our ideas. The law also requires that we propose allocation of costs between the state and interested parties. So we'll be developing some information along those lines. Asset management is another key consideration. In Duluth and St. Paul, those two funds manage their own assets. We select our own money managers. We develop our own asset allocation. We have our own investment policy. We're certainly under state statutes. We have a lot of, I think at the last set of pension commission hearings, you heard Mr. Bicker talk about the guidelines for investing. We're under those same guidelines. So we use those state statutes. We have a legal list. We have all that authority in state law. But we're doing that independently with our own portfolio in Duluth, and same is true with St. Paul. So transition of that responsibility is important. We have today over $200 million that we're managing, and we have to be careful about how to transition those assets over to the State Board of Investment in a prudent and responsible manner. So that's another key consideration. One of the key components of this, from an administrator's point of view, is how to treat the employees of the Duluth plan and the St. Paul teachers plan. I have a small staff. I have 3.5 positions. I'm down to 2.5. Somebody just left, and it was because of all the discussion of merger. You can imagine the stress involved with employees when they hear that your organization will be merged, and what's going to happen to my job? How does that affect me personally? I'm working at the Duluth Teachers Fund. How does that affect me? Me personally, I will not be protected. I'm an executive director, and that position goes away. But the other staff people in my office are critically aware of how this is all happening, how it's being discussed, and part of the law that was passed in the Omnibus Pension Bill indicates that we should be proposing some method for protecting the employees of the Duluth plan and the St. Paul plan in the event of a merger. And again, there's plenty of history and past practice along those lines that we can draw from to protect and to treat the employees of the Duluth and the St. Paul plans in a similar fashion. And, of course, part of all of this is education and communication with stakeholders. Anytime you talk about merging pension funds, the members get a little nervous. We've got active members who are keenly aware of what's happening and retirees who are keenly aware of what's happening. I get calls on a regular basis. What's going to happen to my pension? Will my pension go away? Will it be reduced? Are my benefits that I've earned to date as a working teacher going to be diminished? There's a lot of anxiety when it comes to merging pension funds, and I understand that. I try to assure people that the legislature in the past has been very responsible with members of the plans that are being merged into another plan, and there have not been diminishment of benefits, and employees have been protected, and rights have been protected, and all that is a very good past practice, a history of the Minnesota legislature as they have merged plans. So I feel very comfortable in assuring people that I would expect that that's the approach that the legislature will take with the teacher plans. But nevertheless, it's a nervous time among the ranks in the schools when the talk turns to pensions and with retirees. So we have to be aware of those kind of things. And I think lessening the anxiety happens through education and through communication. So that's what I've been trying to do in Duluth with my employees, with the active teachers, and with the retirees. I'll go on to the next page. And this is more about the process that we followed since the bill has passed. The omnibus bill passed in, I think it was the third week of May 2013, and that Friday we held our first merger meeting. So we were on this immediately. We wanted to get going right away. It's a long, complicated process to develop this report. A lot of thinking goes into it, a lot of communication, a lot of stakeholders. So we've been working diligently, meeting almost every 2 weeks, either in St. Paul at the TRA office or at the St. Paul office. There has been a meeting in Duluth, so I don't have to be the only one commuting all the time to participate in these meetings. But we have met every 2 weeks, almost on a regular basis, to do the work on this study. We have decided that the TRA actuary will take the lead role in doing all the actuarial calculations. So Kavanaugh McDonald is the actuarial firm, and they will be receiving our data. Our data on all of our members and retirees to do all the valuation work that they need to do all the calculations. Same with St. Paul teachers. And then as those reports and as those estimations come out from the Kavanaugh firm, I will be sending them on to our actuarial firm, the Siegel Company, and St. Paul will be doing the same thing with Gabriel Roeder and getting our actuaries will be looking things over, looking for reasonableness, not doing a complete recalculation. I think that's a little bit overkill, but we certainly want to have some oversight as to what's going on and looking for reasonableness in all the calculations. So in reality, you'll have one lead actuary on this project and two others that will be overseeing the process and the calculations to make sure everything looks reasonable. That process has already started. The TRA actuary has received the Duluth data and the St. Paul data, and I think we have some preliminary numbers a little bit early to start talking about that yet. Our boards have not received that information yet, but we are well along in that process of developing the actuarial analysis. The three fund directors met with Governor Dayton's staff about 6 weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago. We met with a couple people in Governor Dayton's office to keep them apprised of the progress that we're making, the method that we're following, and we took that step. We thought that was very important, and we'll probably be meeting with them again because Governor Dayton was an advocate of this study. I think it was one of his main ideas to get this study underway and take a look at this issue. I was personally encouraged by what I heard from the governor's staff. He's very interested in making good on the obligations we have as public pension funds, but he also understands we need to make the funds whole, and so we need to keep our promises, make our funds whole, do the right thing for our members and for the state of Minnesota, but we do have some challenges that we face with unfunded liabilities and some specific things related to the various plans. But and I guess I was also encouraged to hear that he really is interested in seeing the report and finding out the details before he makes any hard, fast decisions. He wants to see the report and then make some conclusions based on that information. So that was all encouraging as we came out of that meeting. So what's left to do here is what's happening in the fall. In September, on the 18th, actually, I think St. Paul and Duluth each have a board meeting that the teacher funds. And what we plan to do is ask our boards, our respective boards, to take a position, a preliminary position, on whether merger makes sense for the Duluth board and for the St. Paul board. We have some preliminary information we'll be sharing with our boards on that day, and the idea will be to take a position one way or the other whether consolidation makes sense for us and whether we're going to pursue it and in what fashion. Again, there's different ways to go into a consolidation, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But in the September board meetings, we expect to ask our boards to take a preliminary decision or position on merger with the TRA. Then at the October or maybe the November board meetings with the TRA, That board, having heard the decision or the preliminary position of the Duluth board and the St. Paul board, the TRA board will take some steps and outline what they feel is the right thing to do as far as funding, looking at the actuarial estimates, the actuarial costs, and the different methods of consolidating the funds, and then they will take a position to as we continue on with this process. And then after that, the three boards now have preliminary positions. The directors and the boards, this is really the study, is a combination of directors' efforts and board members' efforts. We'll continue along with our study, develop our report, taking into consideration the positions of the various boards, complete the report, and then in November or December, ask our boards again to take a final position and where do they land on the question of consolidation. So it's kind of a preliminary position at the beginning, more work, more development, the report will be completed, and then a final position by the boards in December, and that leads right into the publication date. January is when we have our report due to the Pension Commission. So that's our process. That's where we've been so far. I guess at this point I'll let you know from the Duluth perspective, we are definitely leaning in the direction of merging with the TRA. And there's a number of issues that we're dealing with, that a couple of major challenges, one of them being the demographic issue. And I think you've all heard this. We had a large number of retirees this last June. I think 70 or 80 people retired again, and that's a lot of people for Duluth Schools. So our ranks of active members is maybe just over 800 people, and the number of retirees is getting close to 1,500. So that is not a problem in and of itself, but when you have an unfunded liability to the extent that we do have, that creates a very serious challenge and some funding considerations that have to be met, and it's very difficult. We're enjoying some very good markets these days, and that's definitely helping. What the legislature has done in 2010, 2013 has helped a lot, and I credit the legislature for the hard work that they've done and the considerations you've made. The aid that we're receiving, Duluth does not have a long history of state aid, but we have been fortunate to get the assistance of the legislature in 2010 and in 2013. But it looks like it's just going to be too much to overcome, and we have an issue that's very serious, and consolidation seems to be a good solution. So that's I'll tell you now, that's the direction we're heading. It's not official. We'll be taking, like I say, some votes on September 18th to sort of solidify that idea. But that's what we've been talking about at almost every board meeting for a long time. I can't speak for St. Paul. They might have a similar or a different position, but that's the situation that we find ourselves in Duluth. With that, I'll turn it over to Lori, and she'll talk about a little bit more detail in the report.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, and I think it's timely, otherwise I would not have interrupted. Mr. Stoffel, in your testimony today, you said that the teacher, you had 70 to 80 teachers that have retired. I shouldn't say that. You said participants that have retired. Are your principals, assistant superintendents, superintendents covered under the Duluth plan? Are they covered under TRA, or how does that work within your ranks? Where a teacher may become a principal or an assistant principal or an administrator, they stay in the TRA program. How does that work in the Duluth program, if you could, for the community's benefit?
Representative O'Driscoll, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, all the certified teachers, anyone with a license in ISD 709 is in the Duluth Teachers Retirement Plan. So as you're a teacher, you move to the ranks of an assistant principal, a principal, superintendent, all of those are all licensed positions. They are all in our membership. The only people we don't have in the school systems are the clerical, the custodial. Those are the PERA-covered positions. Those are non-licensed. So we have all the licensed. We have nurses, we have counselors, we have anybody like that that has a teaching license in ISD 709.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up, and maybe Ms. Hawking can address this in her comments. If we have an individual who might have been in the employ in a certified position, as Mr. Stoffel had indicated, that moves to a different district that doesn't have its own private pension or its non-TRA pension, how do we determine benefits? So if I might have been an assistant principal for 6 years at a middle school in the Duluth School District, and now I have moved to Hibbing, which is a TRA-covered school, how would we calculate benefits for a pensionee? I don't need to know the answer to that question right now, but I think it's going to be something that, just to get in the way of backgrounding, if you could share that information at some point in your comments today with the commission.
Is it a short answer?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll. We're all of our systems, Duluth, St. Paul, TRA, MSRS, PARA, we're all in what's called the combined service laws. So there is, in a sense, portability among all of our systems. So there, that the person who moves from, let's say, a Duluth-covered position to a TRA position, the benefits are calculated in a holistic way, considering both elements of their service. So they're not disadvantaged by virtue of having their service broken up between two different systems.
Madam Chair, I wanted the commission to have that base of information based on what Mr. Stoffel was laying out as the timeline for the process when we get that January 6th report. I think it's important to know that they're not completely they're portable within the education system within the state of Minnesota. They're not confined to an island of the Duluth Teacher Pension Plan.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Stoffel, I just want to affirm the numbers that I think that I heard, because it was a major consideration in requesting the study be done for the consolidation. Attachment D, at the end of fiscal year 12, we had 919 active members and 1,254 service retirees. And I think I just heard you say that because of demographic changes and the numbers of retirement at the end of June, that 919 number has fallen now to just over 800, and the number of service retirees at 1,500?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the numbers are changing rapidly. We've got a very senior staff in ISD 709. We've got a large bubble of people who are in their 50s and 60s with 30-plus years of service. So we had 80 is a big number for us to retire. And normally it's around 40. So the numbers are, you're correct, the actives are more than 800, maybe 850 in that neighborhood. And I believe we have close to 1,500 retirees.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
And Mr. Stoffel, and maybe you don't have this number off the top of your head, but in terms of the demographics that lead to this reduction, overall reduction, you look in this attachment over the last 5 or 6 years, what's the Duluth enrollment like in terms of pupil enrollment? How's that changed in this last year?
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair and Representative, I have a chart that I have tracked that for a while. It seems to me that student population, I'll put it the other way around, the active teacher population is about 10% of the student population. There was a time when student population in Duluth schools was 20,000 students. Now there's less than 8,000 students. So the 8,000 students translates into about 800 teachers. So that student population has been steadily declining for the last 20 years. I have some information on that if you'd like to receive it. But it's information I received from the school district that shows just a steady decline. I think it's a function of the population in Duluth is really not growing. When I moved up there 20 years ago to take the job, the highway sign said 86,000 people. Today, the highway sign says 86,000 people. The population is aging. There's not a lot of new schools being built. As a matter of fact, the Duluth school system is contracting. They're closing schools. The number of students, the student population is dwindling. Charter schools has an impact on that as well. And private schools, those systems are growing. And the public school is declining. Some of the legislation that occurred regarding charter schools, in 1995, I believe it was, the charter school teachers in Duluth were moved into the TRA. Mm-hmm. That's another part of our demographic story. That by itself doesn't cause a huge problem. There may be 100 or 200 charter school teachers in Duluth, so that's not our salvation, but that's part of the story also.
Thank you. Okay. Any more questions? All right, Ms. Hacking.
Thank you. I'm very last. last slide, which is just an outline, sort of the table of contents of our report. And we've already started to flesh out a lot of this table of contents, but what we're still awaiting finalization of the actuarial numbers and our board's taking positions. You know, we will be outlining the mandate and the study mandate and process under number two. Number three will be just a brief, not as detailed as Larry Martin has put into this memo, but a brief outline of the financial status of our funds, and we will have in this section fairly up-to-date fiscal 2013 for the financial status of the funds. We're also going to be showing just the basic demographic data, some of the questions you've been asking here about trends in population of teachers and benefit recipients. And we'll also be comparing the key actuarial methods and assumptions. In most cases, our assumptions among the three systems are fairly similar. They're going to be different, like for mortality and things like that. They'll reflect the actual experience of our individual funds. But they're, in general, they're the same. But there is one fairly large exception to that, and that is that both Duluth and TRA have fixed amortization periods. In TRA's case, it's a fixed amortization period to 2037. In Duluth's case, it's 2039. So similar. But St. Paul is quite different in the sense that it has a rolling 25-year amortization period. And I'm calling attention to this difference, and we will do that in the report, because when the actuarial numbers are calculated for the amount of state aid that might be needed to bring the systems in fully funded, that makes a big difference, that amortization period. So our actuary will be using the TRA set of assumptions across all of the systems so that you'll have an apples-to-apples comparison and be able to, you know, fairly evaluate what the financial requirements are for consolidation. Roman numeral 4 is just a straightforward comparison, not just of contribution rates, but our main benefit provisions. And this is going to be useful to our staff, respective staff, because we'll be then having to plan to see where there are any differences in benefits. Thus far, they're largely, you know, I'd say 95% we are very similar in our benefit provisions. Those where there are differences, they're relatively minor. Of course, the COLA is an issue. Our COLA, TRA's COLA, is at this point 2%, whereas St. Paul and Duluth will be at 1%. So that'll be a difference. But other than that, most of the other provisions are very similar at this point. The next section is just a history of our financing, funded status, et cetera. Again, Larry has done a very good job summarizing that in his memo. For this report, we're just mainly focusing on financial trends and what has caused difficulties, for example, like Duluth's demographic trends. Roman 6 is the options, will be the options for consolidation. We've already touched on that a bit. There are various funding levels that you'll be looking at, target funded levels. There's some partial consolidation options, full consolidation options, doing things relatively quickly or elongated, so that'll be outlined in this section. The next section is very important. That's the financial impact. That'll contain all of the actuarial analysis, and we will present that in this section. And then the Chapter 8 is asset management, investment-related issues. We're relying on the State Board of Investment to help us with this section. And actually, we've already had a couple of meetings with Mr. Bicker, and I think that he's expressed an opinion that there aren't any barriers or huge hurdles to overcome should the assets be moved over to the State Board of Investment, that can be handled and there aren't any showstoppers or super big difficulties. But we'll cover it in that section. And then Roman numeral 9 will be the positions, recommendations of each of our funds, and Roman 10 will be implementation plans and timelines. just what we hope to work out with our staff to project for you, you know, what's the proper time frame for merger. I know we've had a lot of discussions, especially with Duluth, who's very interested in merging, that we'd like to do this in a careful manner, not too rushed, not overly rushed, so that there's no interruption of, you know, high-quality services to our members. So we'll be attending to that. And then the last section is just communication plans and what we plan to do to communicate with our members.
Any questions? Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Hacking, Roman numeral 4, comparison of contribution rates. Can you talk about that for me, please?
Yes.
What is there? Is there a disparity, or how does it work?
Madam Chair, yes, there are not huge disparities. We'll be looking at the or showing you the contribution rates as they are currently. And actually, we are fairly close. Duluth will, by 2014, get to a contribution level of 7.5% for employee and employer, which is exactly where TRA will be in 2014, next year. In St. Paul's case, they also will get to that rate for the employee, but it's 2 years later in 2016. And their employer rate has been somewhat higher than all of our rates have been. They're going to reach an employer rate of 10.34 by 2017, so they're moving up to a higher rate. I think it's been a in St. Paul's history to have an extra employer contribution to help with their unfunded liability.
Thank you.
On that point, Madam Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Ms. Hacking, on the information that you just presented, does St. Paul or Duluth have help in their employer's contribution other than the school board or school money? Does some money come from the city to the employer's contribution?
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I believe you may be thinking of Minneapolis, for example, mm-hmm. Gets extra aid from the city as well as the state and the school district. But I believe in the case of Duluth and St. Paul, those extra resources have been coming exclusively from the school district.
For Duluth, that's true.
Right. Except, of course, there is the state aid, which you debated and approved this past session. So that,
right, but not historically.
Right.
Thank you.
And Ms. Hacking, when you're looking at the demographic data, is that going to include this issue with student enrollment, declining student enrollment in Duluth?
We can, actually. We hadn't thought of that, but we can add that dynamic to it. Yes, we can do that.
Okay. Any more questions? It looks like you've made a lot of good progress so far. And then I think, we have another interim report from you before the final report? Nope?
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we get off this subject with Duluth, Ms. Hacking, you mentioned that the COLA is going to be different between what TRA has and what Duluth has. Are you just looking at that right now to bring all TRA up to what Duluth has, or is it the other way around? Who has a 2%? You have 2%, mm-hmm. and Duluth has 1%. So
and
is that
St. Paul.
And St. Paul. Is that, are you going to be bringing the COLA up to the 2%? Is that something that is on the table?
Ms. Hacking.
Madam Chair, ultimately it's going, that'll be your decision, the legislature's, because it's all in statute. The calculations that we'll do actuarially will include a 2% COLA, so that you'll know that cost.
Okay. Thank you.
Hopefully that answers.
Yes,
what
it is.
You
thank you.
Getting
it.
Any other questions? All right, then good work, and we'll look forward to hearing the final report in January. The next thing on our – oh, we had Jan Allswiger from Ed, Minnesota wanted to comment on this issue. Welcome to the commission.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. I'll keep my comments brief. We just want to go on record that we definitely want to have a sound and stable pension fund. We are supporting the consolidation study, and we're eager to find out the results in terms of the costs, the changes, et cetera. And, you know, generally large pools do make some sense when you're looking at a change in demographics, as stated by the Duluth Fund. The TRA and the Minneapolis Consolidation Fund went quite well, and I think that with the expertise that TRA and the other funds have, I think that that will be very helpful. And again, we won't take an official position until that study comes out. We do have some principles that we like to adhere to, and we did these had these same principles when we went through the Minneapolis and the TRA consolidation. You know, ideally, we would like to have all of the stakeholders within those teacher pension funds to agree and have a consensus that this is what they would like. I want to make sure that you understand as well that there's a Duluth Pension Fund, the Duluth Teachers Pension Fund, and then there's the Duluth Federation of Teachers. There's also the St. Paul Pension Fund for the teachers and the St. Paul Teachers Union. So I ask you to make sure that you remember that when we're having the discussions as well. So we also believe that TRA should not subsidize the consolidation and that all of the funds should come in wholly funded. And it sounds like that's the intention of the study. And so we appreciate all of their work, and we'll look forward to the results. And if there's any questions or anything that you have that we can be helpful with, please let us know.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Allswiger? Then thank you very much. Oh, wait a minute. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Allswiger, the comment that you made about there's the teacher pension and then there's the teacher federation and then the equal opposite on the St. Paul side, and you said to give that consideration. What consideration are you concerned about that might not be given there that you'd want to bring to the commission's attention?
Madam Chair, Allswiger. Representative O'Driscoll, I really don't have any that I would state here today. I just want to make sure that you are aware that there are two bodies in Duluth that may have the same opinion, may have different opinions, same with St. Paul. I expect that maybe we will all come to an agreement. That is my hope. But I think it's important to know that there are different parties involved.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I don't know if that necessarily answered my question. Maybe I'm just not familiar with the four parties that you're referring to. My original assumption was one was the collective bargaining group, St. Paul, Duluth, and then the others were the two individual pensions. Am I missing something on that? Are there pension benefits that are in the federation that are being offered that I guess I'm confused as to where the crossover is.
Ms. Allswiger.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, no, it is more about there's two boards, two different boards in St. Paul. There's two different boards in Duluth, and they make their own decisions, and they communicate, yes. But I want to make sure that people know that there's two different groups.
Thank you.
Okay. the next thing on the agenda is... Oh, the minutes. Yeah, we have a quorum for the minutes. Does somebody want to move approval of the minutes?
So moved.
Senator Rosen moves approval of the August 28th, 29th minutes, which we've all read, I'm sure. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. So now we're going back to the issue of interest rate assumptions, our second consideration. And is this Mr. Martin again?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Martin.
Members, you again have a memo in your packets. This one is dated September 9th. Unless you have something that you want us to pursue beyond what's here, this is the last consideration of this topic during the interim as we see the topic working out, but we'll be guided by your conversations as part of today's deliberations. What I tried to do in this memo, and I won't go through it in detail, but to pick up on the various interest rate assumption suggestions or alternatives that have been identified or discussed in either the last legislative session or subsequently to try and provide a short summary of what that particular assumption is, and then some sort of a critique of that assumption where there seem to be problems or considerations that may bear on looking favorably upon that particular actuarial assumption. If you remember, our current assumptions are a combination of things, a select and ultimate interest rate assumption, which is relatively unique in the public sector. We have an 8% interest rate assumption for assets related to active members and an 8.5% interest rate assumption for our retired members. We have a 6.5% interest rate assumption for our retired members, and that's for a five-year period.
When does that period, when did it begin and when does it end?
started with the 2012 actuarial work, and we'll go for five valuations. And then it changes back to the prior actuarial assumption, which is 8.5% for active members and 6.5% rather than 6% for retirees. The differential that we have between active members and retired members is a non-explicit way of assuming a post-retirement adjustment. This is the tie-in with Mr. Burek's topic, if you will. We don't have an explicit post-retirement assumption, but we capture the liability and we get we value that by virtue of reducing the interest rate assumption on retired lives. So that's the current somewhat complex set of interest rate assumptions. Now, certainly in this memo, the 8.5% assumption, the 8% assumption, a 7.5% assumption, and a 7% assumption. Might be interested. Turning to pages 7 and 8, the 7% assumption came from something I discovered. Warren Buffett several years ago commented that or had a portion of his chairman's letter for Berkshire Hathaway on public sector pension plan actuarial interest rate assumptions and suggested that it ought to be 7% or less. And so I've tried to capture what Mr. Buffett provided here. And I also looked at what the Berkshire Hathaway performance has been over time, and that's on the bottom of page 7 and the bottom of page 8, just to provide some counterpoint, perhaps, or just thought you might be interested in that. Two of the things that you heard about with the state economist last time we looked at this topic are dealt with starting on page 8. This is the fair value approach or credit risk-free actuarial assumption approach. This is trying to capture what the economist's perspective is on liabilities and trying to factor in not just the investment risk that's involved in our public pension plans, but also the risk or the lack of variability in the pension payouts. The theory being that because the pension is a virtual certainty that it will be paid and will be paid for a certain period of time. That we the volatility that's in the investment portfolios creates, in effect, an extra risk because one is virtually risk-free and the other is relatively risky. that we need to use a different and lower interest rate assumption to capture this extra risk. And the suggestion frequently is to use U.S. Treasury bonds, which at least as of mid-August were yielding under 4%. So a 4% interest rate assumption rather than an 8.5% is a significant shift in our plans. On the bottom of page 9 is the high-grade taxable bond index interest rate assumption. This is something that is related to Moody's, one of the bond rating entities. And Moody's has announced as of this summer that they're going to, in their analysis of governmental jurisdictions, adapt the actuarial work for the public pension plans involved with that particular bond, that particular debt issuer, because they think that the pension obligation is undervalued, is too low, and they're suggesting. Well, their recalculation is going to use a rule of thumb, if you will, that would increase the liability of the plan by 13% or 14% for each percentage point that the interest rate that they think it ought to be is lower than the interest rate used by the public employee pension plan. And they're using an interest rate that is produced by Citibank, the Citibank Pension Liability Index, which apparently is used in the private sector. And on page 10, I've given you a sense of what that rate is, and it's hanging in the high 4% currently, if you look at that table, and the graph shows you what that's done over time. Give you some idea of what Minnesota's pension liabilities and funding position is looking like. On page 11, there's a table there that gives you the current funding ratio of our plans as the first column of numbers on the left, and then I adjusted the accrued liability number based on difference between our current rates and the Citibank rate, and you can see that our funding ratios drop in by roughly 30 percentage points or thereabouts. So a significant increase in what they're recognizing as the pension plan liabilities, and if we saw value in that, we could replicate. So those are the various alternatives that I've tried to give you some sense of and critique. I do make something of an argument on page 11, just pointing out that the actuarial process is not without self-correction mechanisms, because if we guess wrong with the interest rate assumption, it's not that we will travel merrily along, never knowing that we have a problem and all of a sudden run out of money. Every year, because the actuarial process revalues the plan, there are gains and losses recognized. And if we're amortizing our unfunded pension liabilities in a responsible way, those gains and losses work into that increased amortization requirement. And if we reset our employer and member contribution rates or find other funding mechanisms to match the increase in the amortization contribution, we will come out with sufficient assets over time. There will be some modest difference in the timing of when the contributions are made. The process will delay it slightly. But if we're greatly out of whack, we will start to see it in increased unfunded liabilities and increased amortization contributions.
Madam Chair,
Senator Johnson.
Question for Mr. Martin. So you say in here, if the state of Minnesota adheres faithfully to the plan, that it will self-correct.
Yes.
Would you say that the state of Minnesota does adhere faithfully to the plan?
Madam Chair, Senator, over a long period of time, yes. The balance of the memo does point out a couple of areas that I see as problematic where we're perhaps not following the mechanism the way it ought to be followed. What I'm really referring to is the somewhat regular pattern, well, using a level percentage of covered pay rather than a level dollar amortization process is one. And the other is a fairly regular resetting of the amortization target date. If you think of this in terms of a mortgage, most banks, most mortgages are level dollar payoffs. You make the same mortgage payment to the bank month after month after month. It's not set as a certain percentage of presumably an increasing salary that you have. And if you look on page 14, might give you a sense of what the difference is. The graph on top of page 14 is lifted from a piece that the Siegel Company produced for, I believe, the Government Finance Officers Association or the Society of Actuaries, I forget which. The uncolored level boxes, the flat line item there, is the level dollar amortization of $1 million unfunded pension liability. And the increasing step rates that you see, there are three of them there, are the level percentage of pay contributions as dollar amounts. And you can see in all but the shortest one of those that it starts below the level dollar amortization interest or level dollar amortization contribution and goes up over time. And if it's a 30-year level percentage of payroll amortization, the amount of the graph that's above the level dollar gets quite considerable in those later years. That's the system that we're currently using, is the level percentage of covered pay, and we use it, and we've used historically a 30-year period to amortize. So what we have is a system where we're not paying all of the interest on the unfunded liability in the early, essentially one-third to one-half of the amortization period. And we're really expecting a lot of the amortization to be made in the very last years of the amortization period. So we've got a problem. We're betting on the future to a considerable extent using the level percentage of pay system. The other factor that I cite or would raise with you is that we reset these amortization periods periodically whenever we get in trouble, as it were. 2010, one of the things that was part of the sustainability legislation was a resetting of several of the amortization dates. As soon as you reset the date, you go back to the very start of this graph where you're paying less than what it would take to pay the interest on the unfunded, and you push off into the future that expected set of balloon payments that represent the end. If we were to hold to the amortization dates in a fairly strict manner, we will ultimately work it out. If the if the covered salaries go up as predicted. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that Duluth Teachers has with a declining enrollment, a declining teacher base, we're expecting that payroll to increase, and it's not increasing, or it's not increasing anything like it ought to be increasing. So the bet is skewed right there. It's very unlikely that Duluth can amortize, even if they had no deficiency in their current contributions. simply because their total covered payroll is not going to keep pace with where it ought to. The balloons that we expect at the end of this payment period, this will not occur.
Right.
If you're interested, on page 14, the table of numbers gives you the current situation, the unfunded accrued liability amounts of our various plans, what the 8% interest amount is payable on those unfundeds, compares the actual contribution that should be made, the actual contribution that's currently being made in these plans, and gives you the difference. And in every case, we're not paying the full interest, the full 8% interest on our unfunded pension liabilities. We're still in this very we're in the first third or first half of this amortization payment graph that you see up on top. I provided in the rest of the memo what the legislation would look like if you wanted to do something different, if you wanted to go back to level dollar amortization, which was what was the method that was used by Minnesota before 1984. I've shown you what that would look like in legislation. If you wanted to get rid of the implicit assumption about post-retirement adjustments by reducing the interest rate assumption for retired lives and just have a straight-up prediction as to what our post-retirement increases are going to be and for what period, I have a draft of what that would look like. And if you wanted to reset the amortization periods in a more consistent fashion and have them only change when we change actuarial assumptions or increase benefits or have very significant experience losses, I've got a draft that I would do that. So they're more thought pieces, they're more suggestions for what could be done to strengthen our adherence to the actuarial process as it was envisioned.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Mr. Martin, is there a way to back into then, if we looked at the level annual payment in the Duluth situation, for example, if we look at the active versus the active members versus the retirees, service retirees, is there a way to come up with an approximate number of the amount of active members it would take in order, even at a level payment system, to meet the obligation for it not to be unfunded? I mean, how far deficient are they in terms of that?
Madam Chair, Representative, the fact that the number of active members is declining mm-hmm. makes it tricky. If it were to stabilize, then it's just a question of how big the pay increases that the remaining active members would be getting. We changed the Duluth payroll increase assumption this last year. And I think it's 3 or 3.5%. Mr. Stoffel may be able to tell us. I'd have to look in the statute book. We reduced it by a percent or a percent and a half, so we're less optimistic about the pay increases. But it's very hard to know how the teacher population is going to play out.
You
can mathematically back into it what the payroll would have to increase by in order to make this work. If you had a stable teacher population, having both variables moving, it's beyond what I can do at any rate.
Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to underscore two things that were mentioned, one by Senator Johnson. And your point is well made when you say strict adherence to. And what human nature tells us is that we don't want to stick to things that we don't like. And one of the things that we don't like to do is to, quote, unquote, overcharge people if for some reason in a temporary snapshot in time the fund looks like it's overfunded. more than 100%, or if we're underfunded and we're down in some of these funds where we're at 60 or 70%, those outlying points from the standard or from the bullseye, those standard deviations, gets us queasy as just human nature. And so it means in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health, we just continue to move forward with those kinds of things. That does help us to get to the plan. And any investment advisor or financial planner who sits down with clients will tell them that. But boy, I shouldn't be buying more now because the market's high. I should be buying, I don't want to buy any more now because the markets are down. They could go down further. And so we've got human nature that's in that. The second thing is when Mr. Martin's talking about a mortgage amortization and paying that off over a period of time, we used to have a product in the marketplace called a negative amortization loan. And all it did was tell people that in the beginning of your mortgage payment, we're going to have those payments be underwritten. So if you make a $500 payment to your lender, yeah, your interest might have been $625 on that, but that's okay. Just pay us $500, and we'll lump the other $125 onto to the value of the mortgage. And then as time goes on, we'll increase that. And as he had just pointed out, Mr. Martin, that is, that at the end of the amortization, or the end of the life of that, is when you have the most amortization. That's the hardest part. And that's my fear, is that if we don't hit this right and set this on a trajectory that's going to work, we're going to be having to backfill an awful lot. Well, most of those mortgages that I'm referring to never got paid off because one of two things happened. They either refinanced or they got foreclosed on. And the majority of them got foreclosed on because the value of real estate was coming down and there was more owed against that real estate than the lender had a comfort level in lending. So we don't allow those kinds of mortgages to be offered in the marketplace anymore. So since Mr. Martin brought up the mortgage analogy, I thought I'd just give a little perspective from the real estate industry and where we had been at with that type of a protocol in the past as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
My words were taken right from Mr. Martin's memo, and I said, if adhered to faithfully, and I really appreciate the staff's information that has been provided to me and to all of us, and I think it's up to us then to take the advice and the information that is brought to us by people who are much more skilled and much more knowledgeable of this information than myself, for sure, that I would listen to what those people have to say and then maybe do something about it. And, in fact, the bill drafts are here, and we can change them if we want to. And so it's up to us to watch that.
Mr. Martin, do you remember in 1984, why did the finance department recommend discontinuing the level dollar amortization method?
Madam Chair, I need to preface this by indicating I wasn't here in 1984.
Okay.
I was in Pennsylvania working for the Pennsylvania Pension Commission trying to solve the funding problems of 3,000 pension plans out there. But I do remember some of the stories. There was a concern that if you use level dollar amortization, because a lot of the unfunded gets paid off in the early part of the amortization period by its nature, and salaries do go up, and most of these are ongoing pension plans that will have increased, at least stable membership or increased membership, that we're actually paying more than we would have to in the early days.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it be nice if we could level that out
mm-hmm.
over successions of taxpayers?
Mm-hmm.
And mathematically, there's nothing wrong with that mm-hmm. notion per se.
Mm-hmm.
But dollars that you don't have in a pension, that you don't have in a pension fund, mm-hmm. you either have to make up the lost investment performance on them, or you suffer the loss, and that's what we're doing now. In general, the finance department didn't like the pension commission coming back periodically and suggesting that we needed more contributions to our various pension plans, and one of the ways to moderate those demands for additional contributions mm-hmm. was to change the amortization period.
Mm-hmm.
Other things were also done in 84. That was when we shifted from a 5% interest rate assumption to an 8% interest rate assumption. And prior to 84, we did not value assets at anything like market value. And they, in 84, the legislature bought into a recommendation from the finance department to use book value plus some percentage, I think a third of the difference between book and market. So we had an increase in our recognized value of assets at the same time. So that allowed, well, that took some of the funding strain off of the demands for additional revenue for pension plans. And some of those things needed to be done. Valuing assets at book probably isn't a wise idea, no matter how you cut it.
Were we having some difficult economic times around then? I was just elected that year, so I don't
what
remember.
Year?
84.
That was recession.
Madam Chair, that was the egg crisis, and we were having a lot of problems in the state around then.
It followed a succession of problems. I think there were three special sessions in 82 and a couple in 83.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson.
And another comment, and I'm learning a lot about this, and there's much more to learn. But, speaking on this subject, I don't think we thought about teachers not getting any salary increases, like at Anoka Hennepin School District that I represent, for I think 3 years, if I'm not mistaken, they didn't get any salary increases. That is one of the reasons there's this problem. I take it from you, Mr. Martin, that you don't have to give me all the information, but am I kind of on the right track?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Senator, Mr. Martin.
There are a number of things going on.
Right.
But
I just
no salary increases over a widespread population will have an impact.
Because they're not then contributing more into the pension fund.
Yes.
Did you want to continue, Mr. Martin? Do you have more?
No, Madam Chair. I think that covers my memo at this point. Mr. Slocum is here, the Duluth Teachers Pension Advisor, Investment Advisor. That rounds out what hearing from the various investment folk from the various pension plans, and that may be informative.
Okay, Mr. Slocum. Representative Murphy.
Before we leave Mr. Martin's memo and possible options for us to consider, I don't completely understand, and I don't need an explanation right now, but sometime between now and the next meeting, we should talk. But what you said about Warren Buffett and Citibank, not separately, separate things, are one of these options that you have presented to us in amendment forms or bill forms. Warren Buffett information be on one of these options, and would the Citibank be on one of these options?
Madam Chair, no. They're arguing for a lower interest rate assumption in each case, and significantly lower. What I was looking at is more structural questions about how we amortize our unfundeds, whether we use an implicit actuarial assumption as to post-retirement increases, or we do an explicit assumption. So it's more structural questions that I was looking at in the drafts, because they're conceptually harder to envision in some ways. I thought a draft would allow especially the interested parties to get a sense of what I'm suggesting here, to trying to describe in a paragraph or a couple of sentences. There, none of the drafts change our current interest rate assumptions, except for the draft that has to do with separating out the implicit assumption as to post-retirement increases from the interest rate assumption. And that allows you to go to a higher interest rate assumption on all assets, because we're not discounting one, dropping one, to pick up a liability that we're not recognizing in any other way.
Thank you for that clarification.
That would be the first one.
Mr. Slocum? Mr. Stoffel? Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members again. Jay Stoffel, Director of the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. With me today is the Jeff of Jeffrey Slocum and Associates, the consulting firm that we employ, that we retain to help us with our investment management. I'll begin. I'll be working from the document I think that Lisa just distributed. It's titled, it's got a Slocum cover on it, and Pension Commission meeting, September 2013. I will start off by doing a quick snapshot of our portfolio and our recent investment returns. On page 2 is our asset allocation in pie chart form and with respective numbers associated with each asset class. This is where we are as of today, June 30, 2013. This asset allocation looks probably something very close to what you saw from the State Board of Investments in the St. Paul Teachers Fund. We have domestic equity of about 34%, international equity 25%, fixed income bond-related investments of 18%, alternative equity.
Excuse me, Mr. Stoffel. Does somebody have their cell phone by the mic?
That's work on the capital. That's a hammer.
Oh,
drill.
I see.
I recognize the sound.
All right. I'm sorry.
To the contractor in the group.
I'll continue on, Madam Chair. Alternative equity, and that primarily includes private equity, a few other smaller alternative type investments that we make of about 18.5%. And as of June 30, we had about $10 million in cash, so that's about 5% of the portfolio. And that is a little bit high compared to normal. On average, we're probably running something closer to 2 or 3%, but that fluctuates. We are required by law to have enough cash on hand for short-term liquidity purposes so that we can pay retirement benefits. And as we go through that exercise every 6 months, we build up our cash reserves, we work it down, and we build it back up again. So this, I think, looks like a kind of a high point for us. And over a six-month period of time, that dwindles down to not quite zero, but almost zero. That's the exercise we go through every 6 months to manage our cash. So that's our asset allocation. And it does
question
change.
Question from Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just talking about your alternate and alternative equity investments and stuff, could you just give us a little bit of an idea? We asked Mr. Bicker that from the SBI when he was here a few weeks ago, just to give the commission a flavor of what we're looking at in that investment mix, since it does constitute just about 20% of the total portfolio.
Okay. Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, our alternative equity is primarily comprised of private equity, and inside of private equity there are several sleeves. We use a firm in Boston called HarborVest, and with HarborVest we have venture capital, we have leveraged buyout investments, we have some international private equity, and something else that's in the business called secondaries. Those are limited partnership private equity positions that other investors are selling because they have their reasons to get out, and we are buying. That's the secondary sleeve of our private equity. So that for the most – well, and then a couple of other private equity investments with North Sky Capital. They're in Minneapolis. Used to be the Piper Jaffray sleeve of the private equity sleeve of the Piper Jaffray firm. North Sky split out from Piper Jaffray, and now they're independent from Piper. And we had originally invested with Piper private equity and with Piper. Now North Sky, it's just venture capital and leveraged buyout. So it's a very diversified domestic, international piece of private equity. And then there are a couple of other things we do, a smaller thing with PIMCO, Pacific Investment Management Company in California, and BlackRock, and a small firm in Boston called Permal. And those are all either secondary investments or some kind of opportunistic investing that we've been doing lately. So that hopefully gives you a flavor for that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I have not read your investment policy statement and your investment allocations. Do you have an upper limit on how much you'll put into alternative equity investments?
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, yes, there is an upper limit. I believe there's an upper limit in statute, and then we have an upper limit in policy.
the top of my head, I can't recite exactly what it is, but it's not outrageously high. It's not a 50%. It's probably something closer to 20% or something along those lines. I can get back to you on that if you'd like. But, again, the statutes that we operate under are the same as what the State Board of Investment has and the St. Paul Teachers. So they have very, again, they're not onerous limitations, and I think they're good limitations that we have. But we certainly appreciate the ability to have diversification in our portfolio and to get into these asset classes that, although they can be higher risk, generate higher returns.
Representative Driscoll.
To Mr. Stovall's question, I don't need to know that number specifically. My assumption was it was close to 20%, since you're at 18.4 right now, and I assume that you'd auto-balance back to something at or below that number at some point. So that satisfies my question. Thank you.
Welcome.
Okay, Mr. Slocum, Mr. Slocum, and Mr. Stoffel.
Okay, Madam Chair, and the last point on asset allocation is it does change over time, not radically. We don't really time the market. We're long-term investors. We will tweak things every now and then, get into new asset classes and various things, but for the most part, we really don't change wholesale our investment allocation over time. It sort of evolves slowly, sort of like as a glacier moving. It does change, but not rapidly. The next page, 3. Gets into our investment performance. And these are our investment returns, total fund portfolio it's in two forms. The bar chart you can see on the top of the page, but the numbers in the graph in the bottom of the page, individual, and these are fiscal year totals, so June 30 year ends. So June 30, 2009, the second year of the Great Recession, it was a pretty dramatic year. It was not a good time to be investing money, no matter who you were, but that was a very negative year, but a very substantial rebound in fiscal year 10 and 11. Fiscal 12 was a little bit flat, but fiscal 13, we experienced a 17.2% return, and I believe that's top decile in the nation. Happy with that kind of a return. But you can see the annualized meaning on average, if you took our returns over 3 years, the average out at 13.4. Average over 5 years, which incorporates the 2009 year, drops down to 4.7. But over longer periods of time, 25 and 30 years, you can see that our annualized investment return is quite strong, 8.8% and 11.6%. That's our history, and that's where we've been as of the last fiscal year end. I will now turn it over to Jeff Slocum. He is the investment consultant that we have used, I think it's approaching 25 years, and Jeff and his firm help us with investment policy. Again, we operate under state statute, but within that environment we have a separate document, an investment policy document that clearly lays out our asset allocation and how we manage our money managers and all the various parts of our investment portfolio. Jeff and his firm help us set the asset allocation. So when you see that pie chart, Jeff's firm is helping us, the board, decide how big each slices of the pie should be. His firm helps us select money managers, monitor the managers as we go through the year, and Jeff's firm comes to our board meetings 4 times a year to keep an eye on investment performance, what's happening with our money management firms, are there things happening that we need to be aware of. Sometimes there are things internal at money management firms that you don't necessarily like and it's time to change. And then they get involved with any kind of studies or projects that we have along the way as well. So Jeff and his firm have been very intricately involved with our fund on the asset management side for a long time. And I'll turn the rest over to Jeff.
Mr. Slocum, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 5, there's a little more about my firm. We were established in Minneapolis in 1986. We're registered with the SEC. When we say we are completely independent, what we mean is that there is just one source of revenue for us, which is the consulting fees that fund sponsor organizations pay us. So we don't sell investments. We don't. We're not interested in transaction fees. We have one source of revenue. And our business is approximately a third, retirement plans, nonprofit healthcare entities, and endowments and foundations.
You don't do individuals?
This firm does not. We have a separate firm that does work with private wealth. The institutional business is just under 120 clients, about $100 billion in assets. We have a separate research team that is dedicated exclusively to research, and we have 20 consulting professionals, and we force them all through the death march of the various certification programs for professional certifications. On the next page, in talking about what constitutes an appropriate assumed rate of return, the answer is there isn't a magic number, as I'm sure you've discovered. And you can pick really any number you like, but the number that you pick has implications. And the higher the number, the more comfortable the institution needs to be with volatility. And somebody could say, well, you could pick a 20% targeted rate of return, and that would mean you'd have to squeeze tight and swing as hard as you can. But there are things you could do that would give you a reasonable shot at hitting a 20% rate of return. It would come with substantial risk and substantial volatility. 2% used to be a very, very easy rate of return. Things are different today. But I think when we look at an 8% return, in our view, it's not unreasonable. It just has implications. It has implications for the types of investments that would constitute the major portion of the asset allocation. They are going to be types of investments that, in general, will have greater period-to-period volatility. And the idea here is that the wider the swings from period to period in returns, the more unpredictable they are, and therefore the greater the risk. The longer the time horizon an institution has in looking at expected rates of return, the greater the probability that the return will approach expectations. And so the higher the return expectation, the longer you need to wait in order for the odds to kind of come into your favor. The shorter periods are much more governed by random events. So 8% in our view is achievable. 8.5% is achievable. It requires, as I say, a longer time horizon and ability to absorb shorter-term losses and a willingness to kind of stick with the program. And it requires that the types of investments be tilted toward investments that have a wider range of volatility. In our view, a pension fund is well-suited to have a longer time horizon. You've got a long working life for most participants, and with the improvements in healthcare, a long retired life. As opposed to a lot of institutions that have really annual budget cycles, I think a pension fund has the ability to withstand a little longer time horizon. On page 7, we're talking here about the value added of the investment program relative to benchmarks. The investment world, as I'm sure you're aware, is full of Greek acronyms and things. And when we're talking about alpha, there's alpha and there's beta. In an investment asset class like the stock market, beta refers to the return that's attributable to just the movement of the overall market. And when people talk about the stock market, the market is up, the market is down. And that overall market movement we would think of as beta. If you break that out, and you can mathematically, you can look at an individual stock, and most of the movement in the price up and down of an individual stock is attributable to characteristics that are unique to that particular company. They have a new product, they have new management, something bad happens to them. And when you build a portfolio of these individual stocks, what you find is those characteristics unique to the individual companies start to cancel each other out. Something unexpectedly good happens to one company, something unexpectedly bad happens to another company. And what you're left with increasingly, explaining the movement up and down in the value of the portfolio, is the overall market risk, or beta. And investment managers can measure this to several decimal points, and they think of it as like the accelerator on your car. You can structure a portfolio to amplify these market moves. And so if the market is up, you tend to be up more. If the market is down, you tend to be down more. Or they can structure the portfolio to dampen the market moves, such that if the market is up, you're not up as much. But if the market is down, you're not down as much. The component of return that is not associated with the overall market movement is the alpha. And it's attributable to the individual security selection. It's attributable to sector weighting decisions. It's attributable to active management. There is a substantial reordering of the investment structure at the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund in 2011. And the taxonomy of investing was shifted. We don't really think in terms of stocks, bonds, cash, alternative assets anymore, but we think in terms of these buckets that are on the left side of page 7 that are really functional. What is it that you want this particular investment to do? Do you want it to be a return enhancer? Well, the return enhancers are the components that are expected to provide the growth. And they come with higher volatility. And in this case, the benchmark is the All-Country World Index of the stock market. And we differentiate them from the portfolio stabilizers that are intended to provide a cushion, particularly in bad times. The benchmark for the stabilizers is the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index. We have components of the investment structure that are designed to provide a hedge against inflation or deflation, and that's the economic hedge component. And then there is an opportunistic piece, which is not something that is expected to provide some sort of systematic return, but rather it's something that over some brief window of time, 3, 5, 7 years, is expected to provide an enhanced return, and then the opportunity goes away and you have to find something else. So our expectation for the opportunistic piece is that it provide a big return. It's got to provide a double-digit rate of return on an annualized basis. The period since this reorganization and the redefinition of the components is admittedly a brief one, but over that period, the annualized return has been 9.4%, and the benchmark has been 5.3. So there's been excess return, or alpha, of 4%. So when we think about the return expectation for the overall fund, we have expectations based on overall market moves, but then we also have an expectation of some enhancement attributable to the active management of the portfolio. And then finally, on page 8, we simply look at a longer-term history using just market returns. So over the last 20 years, a portfolio that was 60% equities represented by the S&P 500 and 40% bonds represented by the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index would have earned a return on an annualized basis of 8%. So, again, when you posit that an 8% assumed rate of return is reasonable, over the last 20 years, it's been possible with a kind of just naive, easily constructed portfolio. If you look at an 80-20 split of 80% equities, 20% fixed income, which is roughly comparable to the current asset allocation for the Duluth Teachers, that return was even better at 8.4% annualized. If you look at a longer period, the returns are even higher. So, it's not a great leap of imagination to say that 8% is a reasonable return. It has been possible. There are many things that people focus on when they think about the future. They think about demographic issues. They think about the economic problems that the world has with the debt levels and demographic issues in other countries, and they're positing a lower rate of growth. But there are also things that happen over a 20, 30-year period that you can't anticipate, like a transformative technology. If you think about the way that the last 35 years have been affected by the development of the personal computer and the productivity enhancements that were attributable to its rise in use. If you think about things like China coming onto the global economic stage and the ability for companies to do more with less, those are events that were not really and you weren't able to anticipate them, but had profound effects on the returns that were available. And so as we look forward, I know that there are things that I have no idea what they will be, but I know that there are things out there that will have profound effects on the ability to earn the 8%. Some may be positive, some may be negative, but in our best guess, I think an 8% and then ultimately 8.5% assumed actuarial rate of return is achievable. Provided there is comfort with the ramifications of higher volatility in the near term and with the asset allocation that is there and the ability in some years to endure losses.
Mr. Slocum, that's what you're talking about, volatility, is some years you'll do really well and some years you won't do so well. You could even have losses.
That's correct.
Which we've seen.
When I talk about volatility, I'm really talking about the range of returns you experience period to period. The broader the range, the higher the risk.
Mm-hmm. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Slocum, just a question. Given that the rates of return have been good, I mean, you look at this and given what is attempted to be done here, those are good rates of return. How is it that the pension fund is underfunded? I mean, the targets are being met essentially in the long run, and obviously you have to take some risk, which means goes up and down, the volatility thing, but overall, the rate of return has been where it should be to keep this fund funded. What's happened?
Mr. Slocum.
Madam Chair, if it's okay with Senator Thompson, I'd field that question. My answer would be that the Great Recession had a significant impact on the condition of the Duluth Teachers Pension Fund, number one. Going into that recession, we were nearly fully funded. In 2005, 2006, we were in the 90% range, close to 100% on a market basis, even higher. Going into the recession, coming out of the recession, a lot less. And that was the most single significant impact. And then on top of that, again, with the demographic issues that we're facing, it's just now a lot to overcome.
Senator Thompson.
I actually would like to hear Mr. Slocum's answer.
Well, obviously, 2008 was a horrific year, and there were components of the investment structure that one would have expected to provide substantial defense in that environment that didn't. The bond market outside of treasuries suffered severe capital depreciation in a mark-to-market fashion. And the rebound that we've seen in those areas is part of the reason why there have been good returns in the last couple of years.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Mr. Slocum, the part I don't understand is in all of this we're talking about the long term. Mm-hmm. And so this volatility, that accounts for things like 2008. And it also, we also have volatility the other direction where we do very, very well. So with all due respect, that would be a satisfactory explanation for me with a fund that was opened in 2005 and closed in 2010. Right. But for a fund that's managed over many, many years, the numbers you've given us are telling us that we withstood 2008 and still have a long-run rate of return that's 8 to 11%.
True. The problem is that it's sort of where you draw the line, and 2008 is still recent enough to be exerting a disproportionate effect on the absolute dollar levels of the fund. What we're talking about when we're talking about returns is the compounding of an asset base that was substantially smaller than it was in 2008. And so you get a larger base and endure the loss that we had in 2008 on the larger asset base, and you know, if you draw the line today, we are underfunded.
So we lost enough money that there wasn't the ability to then make money because you had less money you were making money on, and that just compounded the problem.
That's correct. The mathematics of losing money are punishing. Everyone's heard the dictum that if you have a 50% loss, it takes a 100% gain just to get back to zero. And so the mathematics of losing money in investments are really punishing, and the effects are long-lasting.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, if I could also, just another part of the answer, I think, also is the fact that when we're, depending on the funding ratio number you're looking at, if you're looking at the actuarial funding ratio, that still incorporates the losses of 2008 and 2009. We are now building significant gains that we're deferring. So depending on, of course, what happens in the future, if we were just to achieve our 8 or 8.5% earnings assumption, we would then next fiscal year end start amortizing or realizing part of our deferred gains. If you look back on page 3, we have deferred gains in fiscal 10, 11, and 13. Again, who knows what's going to happen in fiscal 14 and 15 and so on, but the only year that we have a negative in that mix is fiscal 2012. So after June 30, 2013 valuation work is finished, that still may result in a decrease in funding ratios because, again, we're taking in the last slice of fiscal 9 that finally falls off of our five-year smoothing, and now we have actuarial gains, investment gains, that we've been deferring 4 out of the last 5 years, or three out of the last four, anyway.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I guess this is more of a comment than a question is if, in fact, we can meet the long-run rate of return expectations, which, again, Mr. Slocum's firm is to be commended. That's well done. And our pensions are still underfunded. Then that tells you we have a defective system because goodness knows where we'd be had that long-run rate of return not been there. And so I'm not hearing that, well, there was any over-expenditure or too much of an increase in benefits. I'm not hearing any of that. I'm kind of hearing, well, this is just math. Well, I'm not saying I accept that, but that's what I'm hearing. Well, if that's the case, then we have a defective system. If we can literally meet our long-run rate of return expectations and, in fact, exceed them and still end up with an underfunded system, then something is dramatically wrong with the system.
And I think that what the merger study is to demonstrate is, given the demographic challenges in Duluth, would they be able to bounce back from this 2009 loss of money eventually? Eventually, would they be able to get back to where they were at, say, 2007? But with the demographic challenges, that's kind of uncertain if that could happen. Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, I still think that the single most important factor in consideration for the merger is going to be the demographic change and the inability, in fact, at looking at the base of what is looking at the investment portfolio and how it won't grow from the amount of active members that are going to be able to contribute. That's going to be the greatest challenge. But I think that we owe it to ourselves, if we're looking at it, to take a look at a broader demographic study on what is the whole state, what is the TRA demographic outlook look like. Mm-hmm. We're going to make this, and I don't have any doubt that that's where we're headed, but I think we owe it to ourselves to at least get what does the long-term picture, because then it gets to Senator Thompson's, and that is, can the system support then a demographic change in the overall system? Because certainly if you believe the state demographer, we have a declining population in school age, and that's ultimately going to lead to more and more pressure on the number of active members, regardless of the fund. And we've got to take that in consideration if we're going to do a long-term study of what needs to be done for the pension funds.
I think we do have a declining Caucasian population, but I think we have a growing diverse population of students. But it would be interesting to see those numbers. Maybe we should get the state demographer in. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things that got me to thinking when Senator Thompson asked his question, and it hadn't occurred to me, but I think it's worth going back and asking. What I'm hearing from the two of you, and I would suspect the same thing from Mr. Bicker and from the folks in St. Paul, would be that 1 year really helped you take it on the chin for all of your averages over that period of time. You still haven't, 7 years later, been able to kind of get on top of that mountain and be king of the hill anymore.
Like 4 years.
What happens in the next 30-year period of time we have a similar event? Is that, and we haven't recovered? I mean, an 8.5% expected rate of return might have been your father's Oldsmobile, but, you know, using Representative Kahn's comment from last time, our Tesla car today is going to be something that maybe we need to be looking at a lower rate of return. It's more predictable. Granted, it's not as pleasant because there's some unintended consequences with it, but no check in the mail is a very unintended and not widely supported concept by the members of this commission nor the members of the beneficiaries of the pension benefits. I don't know if there's necessarily a question. Maybe you can kind of comment on that concept of 1 year seems to have taken it. Not even the events of 12 years ago with September 11th, where we shut the markets down for 3 years and the markets fell. We were able to come back, and that didn't have a prolonged effect. You're tying it all onto the 2008-2009 market losses and the economic events at that point.
Comment, or did you want to have a question?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I guess my comment would be you can ask everybody in the room what their opinion would be about the future, and you get 100 different answers. But I've heard the Great Recession called a once-in-a-lifetime event, and hopefully, I mean, you can't manage pension funds just on hope, but I certainly hope that is the case, that was a once-in-a-lifetime event. It's been compared to the Great Depression, and now we have the Great Recession. I certainly, in 20, 30 years of managing pension funds, have not seen anything like 2008 and 2009. Will that happen again? I certainly hope not. I think we all hope not. It looked like, to me, the global financial system was on the verge of collapse. It affected everything and everybody. Whether that's going to happen again, time will only tell. But time is on our side. I think, as Mr. Slocum pointed out, in managing pension funds, we're not in this business for 10 years, 20 years. It's more active members are working 30, 35 years. Retirees are living 25, 30 years and longer. This is a long-term business, and I think it helps, and it's to our advantage to have that perspective.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, I'm glad that we are having this part of the discussion, because bookending this 30-year period of time is the Great Recession that was what everybody was talking about in 1981-82, the greatest recession since the Great Depression, which got bumped to number two by the events that we've just had recently. So if I'm a person who's caught in the middle of that, I bookend on either end in lousy and horrible times, and I'm supposed to be now drawing a pension from assets that I have no idea the viability in long term. I'm not blaming you. I really am not. I'm just raising questions for this commission to get an understanding that even in a perfect world, in nice charts, that can say this is what happened. But where you fall on those particular events in that 30 or 40 or 50-year period of time is really going to have a direct impact on you. And we can't manage those events. We can put a model out there. We can stay true to that model. But that model is going to have pain in it at some point, at an inflection point. And I don't know if the commission has a full appreciation for that. For my almost 10 years of involvement in the financial services industry, I get that. I mean, I was on the deck when 2001 stuff hit, and a large broker dealer, and so I'm familiar with where that goes and the pains that are involved in that. And 2008 wasn't good for a lot of my counterparts because people lost jobs in the business. So I'm a little sensitive to making sure that we do this right for the people who are out there and the promises that we're making. And it's good to talk in models and formulas and history, but the lower the benchmark, the easier it is to obtain that benchmark.
Madam Chair, it's a moving target. This is difficult business. It's a very difficult exercise. What you did in 2010 and again in 2013 is in reaction to where we are today and where we found ourselves in after 2009. Again, I commend the commission and the legislature for the changes that took place in 2010. I think Part of our history is the cost of living adjustments that were paid. We all look back and say, what if, you know, what if there were caps in those days of on our cost of living adjustments? Lessons learned. Too late, but it's a good lesson, and hopefully it won't be forgotten. A lot of changes have been made. Contribution rates are almost double than what they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Teachers are paying twice as much into their pension fund now as they were 20 years ago. That's a direct impact of what happened in 2008 and 2009. I don't want to minimize 2010, but that was short-lived, and it wasn't as dramatic as 2008 and 2009. It was a part of the investment world. The fixed income, the real estate, cash, and all the precious metals all didn't react in unison like they did in 2008 and 2009. That was a one-time dramatic, hopefully once-in-a-lifetime event that none of us ever want to experience ever again, because it affected every investment in all the same way. Everything was correlated to one, and it all went down. So, you know, again, this is a very difficult exercise, and I really appreciate the work you folks put in to help us manage this. The funds, the unfunded liability is the question today, and the investment assumption. But it's, again, I would encourage you all to think long term. This is not going to be repaired in a year or two. This is going to take time to come out of, and hopefully there's always reversion to the mean. I mean, there's all kinds of fancy phrases we can throw on the table, but I think it just takes constant work and attention, and the Pension Commission, and I think the boards of the respective funds have been trying to do and have done the right thing as we have gone along.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stoffel, Mr. Slocum. We do have the fund directors that wanted to give us some more information on this issue of the interest rate assumptions. If you want to come forward. And there was a hand up. Okay, so what are we looking at here?
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System, and Mr. Martin asked that we put together what our funding ratios and the impact of moving from the current investment return to 8%. And so we have done so. And so if you have the one from the Minnesota PERAs and MSRSs would be both with Gabriel Roder Smith. So if you have the one to the Minnesota State Retirement System, and if we look at page one of which is our large plan, our general state employees retirement system. And essentially, if we look on the right side, the moving from our current discount rate to an 8% discount rate increases our accrued liability by $469 million. It's been a long day. So it increases our unfunded liability by $469 million. If you look to the bottom right, if we then funded that difference, the contribution rates would have to increase by 1.7%. So over what we have now, just moving that interest assumption, investment assumption down would add that unfunded liability and require that contribution rate. For our correctional plan, it adds $44 million in liabilities and would require an additional contribution of 2.4%. And in our state patrol plan, which would be on page 3, it would increase our liabilities about $28 million and would require an additional 4%. So what we did is we had our actuaries put together some numbers. I will tell you the baseline that they started with is 2012. On a market value, 2013 would be a better funding ratio, but I think those numbers would stay about the same as far as what the impact of lowering the investment assumption. And I think the bottom line is, as Mr. Slocum said, it has a big impact. That investment assumption has a big impact. The amortization method you use has a big impact, and you know, anything that you decide to do, you know, should be done as you have been doing, deliberately and carefully, because it means you know, it has some implications.
What does that change your funding ratio to?
Okay, and our funding ratio on an actuarial basis would lower it from 83% to 79%. So currently on a market value basis, if we took today's measurement, we're about 86% funded. It would have it bring us down to about 82% on a market. Just if I brought it forward on a market value.
So, Madam Chair.
And that's not an exact, but roughly it would be the same.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Bergstrom. So some are suggesting we significantly lower that 8% or 8 to even lower 6%, or as some of the numbers that were thrown out earlier today, we would have, again, even larger unfunded liability that we'd have to either make up with state funds or increased contributions from the employers and the employees.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, that's correct. Or through benefit adjustments of some kind, so.
Or state aid. I mean, there's only so many options.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, and then let's look at Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair and members, again, it's the Gaber Roeder Smith letter, and on the second page of the stapled sheet in front of you is our general employees plan. This, too, is based on 7/1/2012 data. If you look at the top, it shows that it would increase, moving to an 8% discount rate would increase our actuarial accrued liability by $723 million. And down at the bottom, in terms of contributions, we would move from having about a 1% deficiency to 2.5%. It worsens the contribution needs by an additional 1.5% of pay. So our current rates are 13.5% of pay. This says in 2012 we needed 14.4, and if we change to 8%, we'd add another 1.5% to our contribution needs. On the back of that same page is our local government correctional plan, which is our best funded plan at PERA. Again, it increases our liability by about $22.7 million. Our contribution goes from 14.4% of pay to 16.1% of pay, a 1.7% change. That would put us into a deficiency in that plan right now. The contributions are in good shape, and that would move us to needing a higher contribution in that plan. The next page is our police and fire fund, which you just made significant improvements to. So these numbers, again, are old. They're based on 2012. It moves us, it increases our unfunded by $329.6 million. Our funded ratio on an actuarial rate goes from 78 to 75, and it worsens our contributions by 3.8% of pay additional need. It was 8.2% that you, a shortfall when you acted on it in 2013, so based on these numbers, it moves up to like 12. Once we have our 2013 numbers with all the changes we made and the better returns, our positions will be better in all of our plans. And then the last page just gives you a snapshot of MRF. The contributions coming into that account that we are managing are stable. They're going to continue as is. But if we move to an 8% rate of return assumption, it goes from a 69% funded level to 68% based on 2012 numbers. So it moves it by 1 percentage point.
So overall, do you have a summary on your funding ratio overall?
Overall, well, our general plan, we lose 2% in funded level on an actuarial basis from 73 to 71.
73 to 71?
Yes. We lose 5 percentage points in the correctional plan from 89 to 84. We lose 3% in the police and fire from 78 to 75.
Although that would change because of more contributions, et cetera.
2013, these are all based on 2012. Actuarial valuations, so our 2013 numbers would all look better.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, Ms. Vanek, you mentioned the MRF fund. How many active employees are still in the MRF fund, still contributing?
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I want to say around 60. They came in, we had a little over 100 when they first came under our administration in 2010, and that is a mature group of people. But also the number of benefit recipients has declined because it was an older population, so there have been more deaths than there have been active members retiring in that plan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Ms. Hacking.
Thank you, Lori Hacking with Teachers Retirement. And my handout's a bit different, but you could go to this page that's got blue and red on it that sort of summarizes everything. Just a little, it's the second page in. And I'd be happy to talk about the other ones, but this is, I think, the main one. A little difference here. I think MSRS and PARA are using FY 2012 numbers, and what's reflected here is, from our actuaries, FY 2013 projections. So they're estimates. They're rough estimates, but they should be fairly correct. And what the red column shows, which is using the 8% interest assumption, is that that would cause a decline in our funded ratio from 71.3% to 68.4%. Our assets, of course, would remain the same. The liabilities would grow by $1 billion. And our deficiency, or required contribution rate, depending on how you want to say it, would grow by 2.5%. Percentage points. So hopefully that gives you the same kind of information that Dave and Mary just went over.
Okay, any questions from members of the commission? Thank you very much for that exercise. You see the reality. So we'll be back tomorrow morning then at 9 o'clock to look at the COLA issue. No other business, then we are in recess until tomorrow morning.
Can we leave everything?
Make tomorrow too. Yeah, I plan us to be here every time, all the time.
That's why I did it the way you did it.
Lisa?
Can
I leave stuff?
Yeah. Members, you may leave all your materials here until tomorrow.
Yeah, go ahead. I don't know why. Wait, this one seems thicker. Oh. I think